Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. He gained the moniker of the Butcher of Bosnia and was accused of war crimes, including the massacre of more than 7,000 men and boys after the brutal wars that devastated the former Yugoslavia in the early 1990s. Former Bosnian Serb General Ratko Mladic finally stood trial at The Hague after 16 years on the run in the biggest war crimes tribunal since Nuremberg. Learn about the historic trial as Frontline goes behind the scenes in the trial of Ratko Mladic tonight. That's at 8 Central, 7 Mountain. It's a two-hour documentary premiering on SDPB TV tonight. As a preview, we are joined this morning by Frontline producer Henry Singer. He is one of Britain's most critically acclaimed documentary directors. He's won or been nominated for every major British documentary award, as well as the Emmy, and his films have been screened at festivals around the world. He is joining us from London. Henry Singer, thank you. It's a pleasure to welcome you to In the Moment today.
Thank you for having me on, Lori.
I want to start with this 16 years on the run, and how much is that gap between when Ratko Mladic is really brought into custody, how does that impact the trial and the evidence and the eyewitnesses?
Well, I think, oddly enough, I would have said probably in a minimal way, in the sense that, as viewers will see tonight, the first witness of the trial is a young man named Elvedon Passage, and he's in his early 40s now. He would have been about, 36 when he testified. He lost his father and uncle, and he tells the story of the day he lost them when he was in a ditch with his father and uncle, and the Serb soldier said, children have to leave the older men, and he didn't want to leave. And you see this young man reliving an experience that took place, some 20, 25 years earlier. So the past is the present in a place like Bosnia. And when it comes to the victims, it's as though it happened yesterday. So even though General Mladic was on the run for all those years, I don't think there was any problem for witnesses from both sides. The film looks at both the defense and the prosecution, recalling events, recalling facts, because it remains extraordinarily vivid for people, and it remains extraordinarily vivid in the region.
That first witness even slips into present tense during his testimony. It's very visceral to him. And I want to talk to you about the kind of access that you were able to acquire for this testimony, where you're talking to General Mladic's family members, the defense attorneys, the prosecution. How did you sort of acquire that or secure that level of access for the Frontline documentary?
Well, I think we were lucky. When it comes to getting access to an institution, there's a certain amount of luck that gets involved. I think with the prosecution, the ICTY, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which was the special tribunal set up by the UN in the mid-90s to prosecute alleged war criminals, the ICTY had been going on for some 20 years, and I think the prosecutors there felt they were doing extraordinary work. They were following in the paths of prosecutors from the Nuremberg trials after World War II, and they felt the world wasn't aware of it. The world wasn't paying attention. So even though I think they felt there was a degree of risk in letting a camera crew follow them around off and on for 5 years, I think they felt it was a risk worth taking because they thought they were doing really significant work. I think when it came to the defense, the Mladic's defense team, I think they felt that they sort of had nothing to lose, that world opinion was so weighted against Mladic. He's synonymous, as you know, with the siege of Sarajevo, with the massacre of 7,000 Muslim men and boys at Srebrenica. And so I think they felt this is a risk worth taking. I co-directed the film with a gentleman named Rob Miller, and we said to them, we will give you a fair shake. You know, this is a film about a trial. You can't have a trial without a defense, and you can't make a film about a trial without including the defense. So we will absolutely give you equal airtime, equal opportunity as we follow the trial. And I think they felt, okay, we don't have a lot to lose. We'll take the risk. So I think we sort of got lucky on from both sides.
And those lawyers are representing not only the general himself, but the people who stand behind him and still see him as a hero and feel like he wasn't going to get a fair shake no matter what. The prosecution is obviously standing in for the victims. And I want to talk a little bit about the charges against Mladic and the importance of the charge of genocide. How hard is this to prove, and why is it so important that the prosecutors do their best to prove it?
I think it's extraordinarily difficult to prove genocide. For the viewers that watch the film tonight, Mladic was charged with 11 counts of crimes against humanity, war crimes and genocide. And genocide is considered the crime of all crimes, so the bar is extraordinarily high. And in the film tonight, we focus on the two genocide charges. There was the charge of genocide in Srebrenica, where Mladic was actually on the ground in Srebrenica. And genocide had been proven against other perpetrators during the lifetime of the tribunal in The Hague, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And Mladic was the top dog. So I think as we went into it, and I think most objective observers would say it would be easier to get that genocide charge proven. He was also charged with genocide in five or six municipalities in Bosnia. The country's divided up into regions or municipalities. And that, as we watched the trial unfold, it felt, again, to us and to objective commentators that the prosecutors had built a very, very strong case. Central to the film, viewers will see tonight, is the discovery of a mass grave in one of the municipalities called Prijedor, where hundreds of bodies were hidden and buried. And that became a crucial linchpin of the prosecutors and the prosecution's case. But we were surprised. He was not found guilty of genocide in Prijedor and the other municipalities. He was found guilty of ethnic cleansing and other crimes. But the genocide charge is very, very difficult to prove, and it's extremely important to prove for the people in Prijedor and the other municipalities. In the film, you'll remember, Laurie, there's the story of a young woman, Elvira Karagic, whose father was 20 years earlier was having coffee with his wife, and Serb soldiers arrived and he disappeared. And she, when that mass grave was found, she hoped against hope that her father's remains might be found in there. And sure enough, they were, which viewers will see. And she lost 32 members of her family, you know, all in just, you know, local villages in the area. So for people like Elvira, and she talks about it, there's something about having genocide proven that is absolutely is so significant for them. Sadly, it wasn't in her case. But that gives you a sense of how significant it is for the people of, certainly of Bosnian Muslims, for that charge to be passed. But for the mothers of Srebrenica, which again is a group of women who lost their husbands and their sons in Srebrenica. Obviously, when Mladic was found guilty of Srebrenica, that was a great moment for them. But it certainly wouldn't bring their loved ones back.
And to be clear, the defense tries different sort of tactics. At one point, they're talking about, you know, what is the difference between sort of forcible transfer versus they're almost painting him as a humanitarian who's offering to evacuate people. At one point, they're saying he has an alibi because he wasn't really in command of the troops because of Serbian law. He was in a car traveling somewhere else. But what do we know about what kind of commander he is? Because there's a lot of video footage of this time and conversations that he had with people, things that he said. What do we know about what kind of commander he was?
Well, I think he was considered to be a very effective commander. One of the defense also argues in the film, and certainly across the case, that Mladic wasn't fully in control. There is the prosecution argues about this, the concepts called chain of command, where that it was the army was very, very well organized, and Mladic was, you know, at the top of the hierarchy, but was very involved and was very aware of what was going on in the field. The defense tries in the film, and you know, we the filmmakers really don't take a view on it. It's really the verdict, which we can talk about, where the audience really figures out what the judges felt was valid and wasn't valid. But the defense argues that Mladic wasn't fully in control, that there was great paranoia and fear among the Serb population going back to World War II when they themselves were victims of a genocide, and that Serbs would have taken arms and defended themselves for fear of another genocide. The prosecution argues that that's just not valid. When you look at Srebrenica, where 7,000 men and boys were killed over 3 days, or if you look at Prijedor and the particular mass grave in Tomašica that we look at in the film, they argue those killings were they were industrial, they were systematic. You couldn't, this wasn't individuals taking matters into their own hands. To kill that many people in that short amount of time, you really needed to have fuel, tanks, diggers. It had to be highly, highly organized. So that's one of the points of contention between the prosecution and the defense. Is Mladic in control? Is there a chain of command? Or, in fact, the chain of command isn't there, and these killings are done by Serb civilians in fear for their lives.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is filmmaker Henry Singer, and we're talking about the trial of Ratko Mladic. It's a new 2-hour documentary from Frontline that airs tonight at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB TV. And Henry, there's footage gathered from these haunted places, the mass grave, victims identifying their families, the prosecution. You can see the sheer exhaustion on their face. As filmmakers sort of witnessing the unfolding of this part of this history, what was it like for you to sort of, you know, watch his expressions in the courtroom, watch the prosecutors talk about the dark places that they were trying to avoid mentally, watch the witnesses sort of break down? What kind of impact did it have on you as a filmmaker?
Well, I sort of specialize in dark subjects, I have to say, and it's not because I'm drawn to the dark, but it's because I consider myself a public service filmmaker, which means that as you're making a film, you really are, you're thinking, you've got your eyes on the prize. You want to do something substantive, subtle, complex, and you want to tell a strong story so the audience will stay with you. So for most of the time, as my co-director Rob and I went through this, I think, you know, we were okay. But I won't lie. There are times when you're so moved. I mean, we've already talked about Elvedine Passage at the top of the program. This young man at 14 having to separate from his father, and still not knowing where his father's remains are, and weeping on the witness stand. You know, that kind of thing stays with you. There'll no doubt be a warning tonight before the program about some of the images in the film, because we also filmed in the morgue at Tomašica at that mass grave I mentioned earlier, and you see not just body parts and sort of corpses, but you see rings, you see clothing. You know, on one hand, because these bodies were really well preserved, you see what you assume is a wedding ring, and you're very quickly reminded that these are people. You know, genocide is an abstract concept. 300 bodies found in a grave is a number. But when you see Elvira that I mentioned earlier, and you see someone working in the morgue laying down the T-shirt that her father was wearing the last time she saw him when he was taken away, you know, that kind of imagery and that kind of moment, it stays with you. And I, you know, we're filmmakers. We dipped in and out for 6 years, but the people you admire are the people that are doing that day in, day out. And as you mentioned, one of the prosecutors, Pete McCloskey, there's a short interview with him in the middle of the film where you really, you know, you really feel that this, that kind of imagery and the kind of testimonies that he's heard over the years and the witnesses he's spoken to, it takes a toll. And again, we were able, I live in London, my co-director lives in London. We flew over to The Hague regularly to film. We flew to Bosnia to film, but we had our homes and families to come back to in London, whereas the people that are doing it day in, day out, these are the people you really, really admire.
And we get the sense of the importance to history that this verdict is what it is and that it's preserved, and this film is part of telling that story of genocide into the future. Henry Singer, for you and Rob Miller, thank you so much for this work, and thank you for joining us today.
Laurie, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for speaking with me.